Hello and welcome to Background Briefing, available 24/7 at ianmasters.com. I'm Ian Masters, and today we'll examine a number of stories and issues in the news. We'll begin with the seismic overnight political change in America following an election that hands all branches of government to the Republicans, who will put their stamp on a reactionary and corporatist Supreme Court that will last for decades. With Trump's inner circle, members of the self-described alt-right, and his campaign having attracted and motivated white nationalists and white supremacists, we'll look into how much the Trump administration will move the country further to the right. Chip Burleigh, an investigative journalist and the senior analyst at Political Research Associates, who is the co-author of Right-Wing Populism in America, Too Close for Comfort, and editor of Eyes Right, Challenging the Right-Wing Backlash, joins us. We will discuss the likelihood that fears of a right-wing insurrection have receded with a Trump victory, but might return if the legitimate anger felt by white working-class voters who are protesting a rigged system in the hope that the political swamp will be drained is not met with genuine reform and income inequality is not addressed. Then we will touch base with Alan Lichtman, an historian at American University who studied both the American right and the presidency and is the author of The Keys to the White House, A Surefire Way to Predicting the Next President, a system that has correctly predicted the outcomes of all U.S. presidential elections since 1984. He joins us to take credit for accurately predicting a Trump victory when all the pollsters and pundits, including me, assumed that Hillary Clinton would beat Trump since he had managed to insult and alienate so many minorities and women in particular. Then finally, we will discuss the irony that Donald Trump won the election campaigning on traditionally Democratic issues, winning key Rust Belt states that have for decades been working-class Democratic strongholds. Gar Alperovitz, an historian, political economist, activist, writer, and government official, joins us. The author of What Must We Do? He was a legislative director of the U.S. House of Representatives and the U.S. Senate and a special assistant in the Department of State, and is the co-founder of the Democracy Collaborative at the University of Maryland. And joining us now is Chip Burleigh, who's an investigative journalist and the senior analyst at Political Research Associates, a nonprofit group that tracks right-wing networks. He studies right-wing movements in the United States, including the religious right, white supremacist, homophobic groups, and paramilitary organizations. He also studies the spread of conspiracy theories in the media and on the internet and political cults on both the right and the left of the political spectrum. He's the co-author of Right-Wing Populism in America, Too Close for Comfort, and editor of Eyes Right, Challenging the Right-Wing Backlash. Welcome to Background Briefing, Chip Burleigh.
Thank you very much.
And already you've got David Duke, the former head of the Ku Klux Klan, which I don't believe is a formidable organization, but nevertheless, they have a nasty history. He's tweeted today, "Make no mistake about it, our people have played a huge role in electing Trump." And then you've got this right-wing radio host Alex Jones tweeting, "We just blew up the Death Star." And of course, Richard Spencer, the president of the White Nationalist National Policy Institute, tweeted, "The Saxon has awoken and the alt-right just won." So I'm not sure that these characters speak for anybody much more themselves, although Trump, I think, Alex Jones has quite a following. So how much is this, is there any sort of sense that these guys got him over the top? It looks like white working class Democrats got him over the top.
Well, they're all notorious blowhards. So, no, I mean, what you had was Trump in the last few weeks very much sending out dog whistles to white nationalists and white supremacist groups and anti-immigrant groups in a way that was very startling. And I think that that helped him. I think that the force behind, I'm going to say there were two large groups that he attracted based on the polling and statistical work that's been done. One was the white working class and one was the white professional middle class. And they both share traditional Democratic ideas about economy, but the Democratic Party walked away from them really after the McGovern campaign in 72 and began drifting towards a kind of neoliberal laissez-faire accommodation, so that you had two neoliberal political parties in America, with people falling down the, well, no, they weren't falling, people being pushed down the economic ladder.
Well, at this in this election, 7 million Democrats who had voted in the last election, and prior to that, in the first Obama election, 9 million more Democrats voted than voted yesterday. So this is an apathy on the Democratic side. 30% of Latinos voted for Trump, and I think a greater number of African Americans. Not that it was a very high number. So there is a, you know, this is not just white men, right?
No, it's not. It's clearly there are other forces, one of which needs to be teased out, which is the role of the Christian right in the United States, in which a number of African Americans and Latinos are active. They constitute traditionally 15% of the voting public over the last 30 years. So we don't know how many of the Latino and African American voters who voted for Trump were voting social issues. Some of them maybe have been voting economic issues based in their ideology. I mean, I once interviewed the head of the militia in Massachusetts who was an African American teacher saying, "Don't you know most of the guys in the militia are kind of racist?" And he goes, "Chip, most of the people in all the groups I work with are racist. I'm a Second Amendment activist." So what really makes someone vote for a political candidate can be very individualized based on these social and or legislative issues.
Well, is it obviously racism is a fact, and Donald Trump started his campaign with a racist put down of Latinos, and it was downhill after that. But sexism seems to have played a role in the Comey letter and the FBI kind of cabal of right-wing Catholics, some of whom are Opus Dei, that just I don't think could stand the idea of a feminist woman pro-choice president. But also, you know, that the impact of that letter is hard to quantify. But there's no question that Hillary Clinton made some terrible campaign mistakes. Apparently, her husband was trying to get her to focus on the very issues that animated the white working class men who voted for Donald Trump, issues about the economy and about outsourcing, etc. But instead, she chose to just say what a terrible guy Donald Trump was, which in the last few days was extremely uninspiring.
So very uninspiring, since so many of the voters who I think either stayed home or voted for Trump recognized with some accuracy that, you know, she was, in fact, Republican light. And so you had racist Republican and Republican light. That's not a very motivating kind of message to be sending to people who are in either economic or economic pain or some fear of their future. Both the working class, which has objectively lost, you know, its economic position, and the professional middle class that fears it, really, I think, followed Trump into the voting booth because they felt that that was their best bet for not sinking. The professional middle class, to a large extent, have not actually sunk, but they're very fearful. And that was, in fact, the class base of support for Hitler in the Weimar period in Germany, was a middle class, a burgher class that was afraid it was about to lose power. So this is an unusual coalition of working class whites who have been pushed down the economic ladder and then professional middle class folks who fear it. And then they want to preserve their relative position of power and privilege.
And again, I'm speaking with Chip Burleigh, who's an investigative journalist and the senior analyst at Political Research Associates, a nonprofit group that tracks right-wing networks. He studies right-wing movements in the United States, including the religious right, white supremacist, homophobic groups, and paramilitary organizations, and also studies the spread of conspiracy theories in the media and on the internet and political cults on both the right and the left of the political spectrum, and is the co-author of Right-Wing Populism in America, Too Close for Comfort, and editor of Eyes Right, Challenging the Right-Wing Backlash. Let's talk about, obviously, now that the possibility of some right-wing backlash or an insurrection which a lot of Democrats thought that was what Trump was talking about when he was saying the election was rigged, those fears of any kind of right-wing insurrection have clearly receded with the Trump victory. But my sense is that the people that he's gotten to vote for him who have legitimate grievances, which again, as we mentioned, the Democrats really didn't address except for Bernie Sanders. And frankly, I think if Bernie Sanders would have run against Donald Trump, he probably would have won. These people who are protesting a rigged system and want the swamp to be drained, I think they're going to be almost certainly disappointed that they've chosen a billionaire who doesn't give a damn about them as their vehicle for change. So when their aspirations are not met with general reform, do you think there will be a backlash?
Well, I think there's already a backlash just the sense that there's been attacks on a number of the individual group members that Trump basically painted targets on their backs. But in this kind of moment, when a right-wing populist wins, you have the people from the ultra-right saying, this is a time for us to recruit and push people towards our agenda of insurrection. So either or both could happen. You could have people moving from the ultra-right into the right-wing populist movement to continue to put pressure on the Republican Party to keep moving to the right. Or you could have people in the ultra-right decide this is the moment a little spark can start a prairie fire. Let's have some actions that move people into our ideological and political activities.
Well, already on the human scale, or in the human dimension here, which I don't think Trump really relates to particularly, the pain he's causing and the anxiety he's causing is immense amongst Latinos, amongst Muslims. People are genuinely fearful. Children are fearful that they're going to be deported. And this all these kids that are here under the DACA program, which was an executive order by Obama, that can be overturned with the stroke of a pen. They get sent back to El Salvador, which is a failed state run by criminal drug-dealing gangs. So their future is extremely bleak. There's a lot that can be done simply in terms of hurting people, most of which feels quite gratuitous, not to mention deporting 11 million people, which I suspect is not quite that easy to do.
Oh, totally gratuitous on Trump's part. It was a campaign maneuver, and he didn't particularly, as you say, he lacks a kind of human touch to understand the pain and agony and fear he's creating, and he doesn't particularly care about it. I think that's really what marks him as a person who is, you know, bereft of certain normal psychological feelings of compassion. I should add, I'm retired from Political Research Associates, but I'm still writing occasionally. And one of the things we looked at Political Research Associates was this dynamic of pitting people against each other as a political maneuver, especially what the founder of Pierre Jean Hardesty, the late Jean Hardesty, said in her book, Mobilizing Resentment. So when you mobilize resentment, you scare people that there are these bad others coming to get us. It's an existential threat, you know, and it's obviously, you know, people talking about the Saxons and Anglo-Saxon, the wasps, you know, has its sting. So that this use of rhetoric to pit people against each other creates fear in one group, but fear in another group that they're about to be attacked. And if this other group of outsiders, these people who don't deserve to be citizens, is built around the idea that there's a conspiracy, a subversive, treacherous, liberal Democratic Party conspiracy, then it begs the question, why not get them before they get us?
Well, I've sort of studied the Trump rallies and talked to a number of journalists who've attended them. And also there have been research done and statistics done on the people that do go to Trump's rallies, and they are in fact statistically the most affluent group of political followers in this country. They're more affluent than Hillary's followers, and more affluent, they're certainly more affluent than Bernie's followers, And so they're not, you know, like out of the swamps of Louisiana.
No. That's why I said there were two. There's two distinct groups. There's the dominantly mobile working class, mm-hmm. which they turn out and vote a lot for Trump. But there's also the professional middle class, and they have relative privilege. They don't want to be pushed down into this great morass of dark-skinned immigrant people and working wage earners. They want to maintain their class position, and they see it potentially slipping. And so they shore up their position by voting for someone like Trump, who is obviously telling them that if he picks up their vote, he will suppress these other people who might pull them down.
So again, I was about to suggest that racism is alive and well in this country. In many ways, I suspect that the Republicans, through the good offices of the Supreme Court that will be even further stacked to the right, have been given Citizens United, which means they have unlimited money. And the Voting Rights Act was gutted, which means they can suppress the vote. But the other part of it is I think they really have revived racism as a way to sort of, in effect, distract people from what they have in common and against a common enemy, which is the plutocracy. I know that sounds like a Marxist analysis, but do you think that that's, at the end of the day, what's going on here, that everybody's getting taken to the cleaners? The idea that an agent of social change would be a selfish billionaire is just mind-boggling. And frankly, this is all about race, this election, and and it's all been revived and it's all working out well, and you've got the Republicans now having the trifecta. So all that talk about the vanishing white man, maybe the problem here is the vanishing Democratic voter who didn't show up. But nevertheless, I'd say this is the triumph of the vanishing white man.
To a large extent, I agree with you that clearly race was the major issue that was used by Trump. But there were a lot of other issues that were woven in, which I think obviously his misogyny, obviously the xenophobia, which was aimed at Muslims, not all of whom are people of color. So he really had a kind of vicious ability to create these scapegoated monsters out to get the real citizens of the country, which obviously in his rhetoric were white people.
So is there any way to predict where we're heading now? It seems like the Republicans, you know, they had that moment of indignation after the Access Hollywood tape where Trump talked about grabbing women's genitals, and all of these pious religious right Republicans, including his own vice president, came out and sort of said, oh my God, I couldn't expose my daughter to that kind of thing. But then none of them really wanted to repudiate him. And one of them, that Jason Chaffetz guy, did. And then he came back and re-endorsed him. And now you've got Paul Ryan just singing Trump's praises, how he the down ticket effect was so great, and credits Donald Trump with this great victory in helping the Republicans hold on to the Senate and the House. So it seems to me that at the end of the day, no matter how obnoxious you are and how vile you are, if you deliver politically and keep these guys in their jobs, they're going to be incredibly obedient.
America, ain't it great? That's the formula, yeah. But I'm white, and I have to confess, did you know that us white people are running out of white people? So the scare here is that, you know, in 30, 40 years, maybe sooner, so-called white people will be a minority in this country. So this is the last gasp of that technique being able to work. And so it doesn't make sense, because if you're planning down the line to be a political party that's viable, you wouldn't basically, you know, swallow a death capsule by attacking the very groups of people that are going to be the majority eventually. So this is a kind of angst-ridden psychological backlash of people who aren't thinking in the long term and are just thinking about their own short-term political gain and how much money they can pull out of the economy in our pockets.
So all of this talk that we have about the millennials, and I've observed it too. I have a millennial daughter, that they are in many ways post-sexual and post-racial. They're not hung up on all the stuff that particularly, the Mike Pences of the world are. And that governor down in North Carolina is obsessed with bathrooms. They're very open-minded in that regard. But did they not show up? I mean, are they a part of this constituency that didn't show up? I mean, they showed up for Bernie Sanders, but I'm not sure. I know the third-party people didn't drain much, except for Gary Johnson. He took, sometimes 6%.
6-7, yeah.
In some states, yeah.
I think, in fact, that they were very hurt by the way that the Democratic Party treated Bernie Sanders, and I think that probably suppressed some of their vote. But I know a lot of folks who were organizing on college campuses and among millennials who said that they were out, ringing doorbells and holding rallies and going to the polls. So I suspect that part of it, and I want to hold her accountable for this, is the fact that Hillary Clinton was not a very attractive politically and economically and socially a candidate, and she failed to deal with the economic problems, which exacerbated the underlying racial problems. And so I think, she was her own worst enemy for the Democratic Party this time.
Well, I'm a friend of Bernie's, and always supported him. And was just absolutely, I couldn't believe that finally we had somebody on the real left in American politics getting exactly. their message out, because it's basically, I'm not saying it's actively suppressed, but it's not, this country's been incredibly hostile to the political left. And after during the Cold War, they all but extinguished it.
Right.
So, exactly. So that's just a reality. But, because I'm pragmatic, I was, basically felt that you had to elect Hillary Clinton, for God's sake, because the alternative was a nightmare. And now we have the nightmare. And of course, you get tons of mail, saying you're shilling for her. So I don't understand the lack of pragmatism on the part of the American left and Democratic voters, where it seems like the perfect is the enemy of the good, and it's so tribal. Yeah. And if casting a vote is not like giving up your virginity. I mean, you live another day, don't you?
Well, I think that's true because there's on the left, people have walked away from any kind of analysis that looks at strategy and tactics as two separate elements of an overall ideological goal. And so I certainly was encouraging people to vote for Hillary and then go out the next day and start organizing against, the neoliberal agenda. But people can't see that now. There's no kind of central ideological push to think strategically and tactically. And I think the millennials are going to pick up on that because they've now had a very hard lesson in it.
So what will it take then to start a new political movement? I've always said if the crackpot Tea Party people can take over the Republican Party and become the tail that wags the dog of the Republican Party, how come a bunch of progressives can't take over the Democratic Party? My sense
is... Well, we did. I mean, a bunch of progressives took over the Democratic Party in 1972 from McGovern.
Right, after Watergate, yeah.
It was, before Watergate, because basically, I don't know how to say this. Look, the Democratic Party inside the Beltway, when McGovern showed up in the Miami Convention, which I covered for the Alternative Press, with all kinds of people who didn't look like the inside the Beltway folks. They were young, they were black, they were immigrant, they were, intellectual lefties. They immediately set out to crush the McGovern campaign. I witnessed that in Colorado, and I wrote about it inside the Democratic National Committee headquarters for the campaign. There were people who had evidence that could have broken open Watergate and shown that there was illegal transfers of money, and they had tape recordings of it. Walter Sheridan, the late Walter Sheridan, had illegal wiretaps that could have broken open Watergate before the election, and he basically did nothing.
Well, just in closing, though, do you think that Elizabeth Warren, Bernie Sanders, although Bernie's an independent, or as he says, a democratic socialist, what do you think? Is there a way to to make the Democratic Party back into a party for working and middle-class Americans?
Just like the right did with the Republican Party. Look, the right worked on the basic models of the civil rights and labor union movement models because we asked them for a PBS series with God on Our Side, and they said, oh, yeah, we learned it from the civil rights and labor movement. So, yes, of course, we can build a movement to take back the Republican Party for actual social change and economic justice, and we might as well just start working on it. But to simply say the system's rigged, people like Alex Jones and other crackpot conspiracy theorists, they disarm us. It's hard work. We build coalitions. We take over the Republican Party. Meanwhile, people are building mass movements to push the Democratic Party to the left. So take over the Democratic Party from the inside while other people are building a social movement, and we'll get back to actual social change and economic justice.
And what kind of, one of the problems I detect with our politics is that we punch our ticket for democracy every 4 years, then we walk away. You know, Obama said, yes, we can. It wasn't, yes, he can. But once he got elected, everybody thought, oh, he's the miracle worker. And then they sort of got disappointed when he didn't deliver. So,
absolutely. Well, you know, if you want democracy, it's like canoeing upstream. If you stop paddling, you go backwards.
I see. So, do you have any sense of what's going to galvanize? I mean, you got all these people walking around today in shock, tearful. The sky has fallen, I don't like the idea that the left is so easily defeated that that we don't expect to win. Almost all of our heroes are martyrs, you know, like Bobby and Martin and Jack Kennedy. They all get shot. You know, so just in closing, is there anything that can buck people's spirits up and get them off their backsides and out on the streets and make change?
Well, it's just, I think, the act of making change. You start to get involved in local struggles, be they around race, class, or gender. You start to work with people. You learn to coordinate and compromise and gain some power locally, and you pick it up. And it's not going to happen top-down. None of these top-down, inside-the-Beltway groups promising social change are going to accomplish this. Local mass-based social movements pull political parties in their direction. It's never the other way around if you want progressive social change.
Well, Chip Alea, thank you very much for joining us here today.
Thank you.
And again, Abby, speaking with Chip Alea, who's an investigative journalist and the former senior analyst at Political Research Associates, a nonprofit group that tracks right-wing networks. He studied right-wing movements in the United States, including the religious right, white supremacist, homophobic groups, and paramilitary organizations, and also studies the spread of conspiracy theories in the media and on the internet, and political cults on both the right and the left of the political spectrum. And he's the co-author of Right-Wing Populism in America, Too Close for Comfort, and editor of Eyes Right, Challenging the Right-Wing Backlash. We're going to take a brief station break. We'll be back with the historian who predicted a Trump victory.
I learned a good way. I learned a good way.
Good way.
I learned a good way of saying goodbye. I learned a good way.
Good way.
I learned a good way.
Good way.
You taught me everything I know about taking other people for a ride. And I just wanted to take the time to thank you for that gift tonight.
Welcome back. I'm Ian Masters, and this is Background Briefing, available 24/7 at ianmasters.com. And joining us now from Doha In the Gulf is Alan Lichtman, an American political historian who teaches at American University and has studied both the American right and the presidency. His books include White Protestant Nation, The Rise of the American Conservative Movement, and The Keys to the White House, a surefire way to predicting the next president. His prediction system has correctly predicted the outcomes of all U.S. presidential elections since 1984, including the election we have just come through or endured, shall we say. Alan, I must say, you got a lot of flack for sticking with your prediction that Donald Trump was going to win. And now that he's won, how do you feel?
Kind of sick. You know, but I think, you know, from my perspective, there are a few positives, not anything having to do with governing the country, but having to do with how we analyze elections. I hope two groups got their comeuppance here. One, the pollsters. Polls are not predictions. Polls are snapshots. They are totally abused and misused as predictions. And all those so-called scientific predictors like Nate Silver are not scientists. They're just clerks. They just compile polls. That's why they were so egregiously wrong this time. Secondly, the pundits. The pundits tied themselves into knots in this election. Just a day ago, they were saying, oh, Donald Trump, that terrible candidate, he's so divisive, he's a sexual predator, you know, the polls show he's bound to lose. A day later, that brilliant Donald Trump, he so brilliantly tapped into the discontent of the American people. Wait a minute, same Donald Trump, same campaign, same pundits, turning 180 degrees around because Donald Trump won rather than lost. If a few percentage points in a few states had flipped, they'd be talking about the dumb and terrible Donald Trump again. So they can never be proven right, and they can never be proven wrong, because they're always following either the last poll or the last election. I would hope this election would lead us into a deeper analysis, like the keys to the White House, and there could be other ways of looking at it too, based on history of what really makes elections work. And the thing that really makes me angry, too, is all of these people blaming it on Hillary. Those were the same people who just, you know, again, just a day ago were saying, boy, you know, that Hillary, she won all those debates. She stood up to Donald Trump. She sure to win. Now the finger of blame is being pointed at Hillary. But the truly sad thing of this election is the destruction of the Democratic Party and the dominance of the Republicans. Republicans now hold the presidency, the House, the Senate. They're going to put their stamp on a conservative Supreme Court for 25 to 30 years. They have the majority of governorships and many more state legislatures, and they're going to control the reapportionment in 2020. The Democratic Party right now is a shadow party, and it's not going to recover by pointing the finger at Hillary Clinton. That's just wrong.
But surely, though, it can recover if it becomes the Democratic Party again, because one of the ironies of the Trump victory was that he, in many ways, he ran as a Democrat. Some of his platforms were identical to Bernie Sanders. And if Bernie Sanders wasn't a shot across the bow, I don't know what was. I mean, all of those, the blue collar, the angry Rust Belt, that was always the Democratic constituency. And surely...
I got you.
Yeah.
I'm a big admirer of Bernie Sanders in many ways. He highlighted really important issues like the need for more comprehensive medical care reform, tuition for college students, income inequality. But he did the country and the Democratic Party an immense disservice by elevating protectionism as though it were a critical progressive issue. Progressivism has always been one of the most reactionary of all policies. Have we forgotten Mr. Hoot and Mr. Smalley, the two very right-wing Republicans who passed the Smoot-Hawley protectionist tariff of 1930 that greatly deepened and lengthened the Great Depression? Protectionism is an absolute dead end. You're not going to bring the steel mills and the coal mines back by attacking NAFTA or the TPP. Those things are gone, and they're not coming back. And you'll never beat the Republicans and the right wing on protectionism. They own that issue. And that was just a terrible thing to see progressivism in America revert to protectionism.
Well, but he was also talked about income inequality and the
power. Oh, I agree with that. I said all that.
Yeah, and the power of the banks. And
sure, I don't disagree with any of that. But protectionism was his most potent theme, and it was the most potent theme of Donald Trump.
Right.
And you can't beat them on protectionism.
So what kind of a Democratic Party do you see? I mean, we were all talking just a couple of days ago about fratricide within the Republican Party, and now they're on a roll, they're united. I mean, today it was amazing to see Paul Ryan talk about we're going to cut down the forests, we're going to pollute the waters. He was excited, and we're going to bring back coal, you know, and of course that will increase global warming. So it's
the planet is, you're right, Ian, the planet is in jeopardy. Everything they want to do is only going to plunge us into the abyss of catastrophic climate change. If you haven't observed the wildfires, the droughts, you have no clue as to what's going on. Climate change, catastrophic climate change is here. It's real. And what they want to do may well be irreversible damage to the planet.
Thank you so much for joining us, Alan Lichtman. I appreciate it.
Okay, Ian. Bye-bye.
And again, I've been speaking with Alan Lichtman, who's an American political historian who teaches at American University and has studied both the American right and the presidency. His books include White Protestant Nation, The Rise of the American Conservative Movement, and The Keys to the White House, a surefire way to predicting the next president. His prediction system has correctly predicted the outcomes of all U.S. presidential elections since 1984, and he correctly predicted that Donald Trump would be the next president of the United States. We're going to take a brief station break. We're back looking into the irony that Donald Trump won the election campaigning on traditional Democratic issues.
I'm looking for a sign. I'm looking for the treason that I knew in 65. Beware the South is yours. Oh, 1984. See, come see, remember me.
They got an all-night movie role. You said it would last, but I guess we enrolled in
1984. Welcome back. I'm Ian Masters, and this is Background Briefing, available 24/7 at ianmasters.com. And joining us now is Guy Alperovitz, who is a historian, political economist, activist, writer, and government official. He's currently a professor of political economy at the University of Maryland, and a former fellow at King's College, Cambridge University, Harvard's Institute for Politics, and a guest scholar at the Brookings Institution. He also served as a legislative director in the U.S. House of Representatives and the U.S. Senate, and as a special assistant at the Department of State. He's the co-founder of the Democracy Collaborative at the University of Maryland, and his latest book is What Then Must We Do? Welcome to Background Briefing, Guy Alperovitz.
Thanks for having me.
And I must say, What Then Must We Do? Certainly applies to the Democrats. They've lost all branches of government, and they're going to lose the Supreme Court for decades to come with a very far right-wing conservative stamp on it. And it was only yesterday that we were speculating, it was only a couple of days ago that we were speculating that there'd be a split within the Republican Party. Obviously, I, along with everybody else, got it wrong because I followed the polls and I thought Hillary Clinton would get a narrow victory. But this surprise victory by Trump indicates that not only are the polls wrong, but it looks as if there will be at least some reckoning within the Democratic Party, if not some reflection.
Yes, I think there's got to be a deep, deep reckoning within the Democratic Party. That's possibly one of the very few positive things that came out of the election. I think there'll be a forced reconsideration both of short-term policy and politics and longer-term policy and politics. That doesn't mean it's going to be easy or indeed that the reflection will go deep enough without active, serious challenge to traditional old ideas of the Democratic Party. there's a major reassessment has to go on.
So do you believe, Garopowitz, that Bernie Sanders would have beaten Donald Trump?
I think he might well have beaten him. He at least was operating on the same terrain. That is, the difficulties facing working families and the need to challenge large corporate and Wall Street interests, and abandoning the establishment posture and establishment connections of Hillary Clinton and the group that was around her. So, yes, I do think he had a chance to beat him, but it's not at all clear that the cultural issues would have worked in his favor. But a real chance was there, possibly one that he could have maximized and achieved a positive outcome.
Well, it's no small irony that in many ways Donald Trump ran a Democratic campaign appealing to working-class Americans, and he won the election in the Rust Belt, which is normally a Democratic stronghold.
Indeed. There's no doubt about particularly the trade policy, which is devastating to the entire Rust Belt, where we've done a lot of work. He spoke to that. He spoke to the trade issue particularly. And I think that was one that Hillary, had been on the wrong side of and had to be forced, kicking and screaming, to even take a position on the Pacific program that's coming up with TPP. So there's no, and also I think that's quite clear that he was angry. I mean, even attacking in some form Wall Street indirectly, his rhetoric was much more appealing as well as his style. The traditional Democratic position had simply run out of gas, and its connection with the established order, and particularly with Wall Street and the trade policies, made it extremely vulnerable to someone like Trump.
Well, but, history tells us from Smoot-Hawley and other that protectionism has catastrophic consequences, and if Donald Trump starts a trade war with China, as he's promised, I can't imagine that's going to be good for anyone. So in terms of the issues over trade, how much do you think NAFTA and all of these other deals, which Donald Trump certainly beat the drum on, are responsible for the Rust Belt? Aren't there other factors like the introduction of robotics? That has changed the automobile industry. So can we have a more nuanced and honest debate about this rather than, revive Smoot-Hawley?
Well, I think, yes, that's the answer. There's two parts to your question, and I think they're both good questions. Undoubtedly, technology and robotics has displaced many people. The first answer to that is a running a full employment economy on even either Keynesian or quasi-socialist principles, managed economy, increases the jobs and stabilizes jobs, even in a situation of robotics. What you get is more income because of the technological change rather than displacing people. So that's the clear answer as we go deeper and deeper into the modern technologies. More serious planning to stabilize and gain the benefits of the technologies, but distribute them fairly in terms of jobs and income. On the trade issue, you need not, I mean, Keynes was, in the sense, a free trader, but you need not go all the way to Smoot-Hawley. What I think most people who are serious about the trade policies are talking about is what's called, quote, managed trade, unquote. That is, not being vulnerable to any and all displacements, but also not making a totally free market open trade system. A planned trade with careful attention to the destructive and very costly, both economically and human costs of simply letting any low-cost producer with no wage standards and no cost standards to displace whole cities and towns. I mean, take a look at Youngstown, Ohio, which has lost its steel industry, and nothing to replace it, which requires a planning system. Or, take Cleveland, Ohio, 900,000 people displaced. Now we're down to less than 400,000 with no strategy to deal either with the trade part of it or with the technology part of it. Or take Detroit, 1 million people lost. And, nobody seems to care where those people went. They don't even ask. But it's 1 million people because there's no alternative system. I think Trump was playing on the deep reality that the Democratic Party and certainly the Republican Party, both of which, attacked him, in fact, had no policies to deal with any of these really severe economic problems. So that's the heart of the matter, and he was exploiting it intensely. Bernie was at least beginning to offer positive answers or stepping stones towards positive answers to all these problems, although I think he would ultimately have to go much further.
And again, I'm speaking with Gar Alperowitz, who is a historian, political economist, activist, writer, and government official. He is the co-founder of the Democracy Collaborative at the University of Maryland, and his latest book is What Then Must We Do? But of course, it's no small irony that the steelworkers in Youngstown are angry, they're out of work, and they voted for Trump. And of course, Ohio being a very key state, but he took all the Rust Belt with him along, you know, Pennsylvania, Wisconsin, and Michigan. And but yet, you know, in terms of the steelworkers out of work in the United States, as it was pointed out during the campaign, Trump built his casino in Las Vegas with Chinese steel.
I certainly am no defender of Donald Trump's ways of trying to, you know, put more money into his own pocket by getting cheap imports. It's in some sense irrelevant, his personal practices, though they are undeniably corrupt and demeaning. The real issue is how you manage these large economic problems, and the Democratic Party simply didn't have any serious answers. Whatever they were proposing exacerbated the problem in terms of trade. So the trade proposals that went forward, both NAFTA under Clinton, the President Clinton, and what's being proposed now and is going to be up in the final session of Congress before the new president comes in, the Pacific Treaty, is they just simply don't deal with the consequences to ordinary workers and people in the United States. So Trump is running against a powerful reality, leaving aside his personal dereliction, not only in terms of importing Chinese steel, but in many other areas where his personal morals and personal strategies hardly matched his public posture.
So how do you think the despondent people in this country, and by the way, they are a majority. It's worth pointing out that Hillary Clinton won the popular vote by 200,000 votes. So there are more despondent people than there are people celebrating. And I must say, one of the most appalling things about this campaign is that there was no ever any mention of climate change virtually, and yet it's the biggest challenge facing the planet, our future, our children, and our grandchildren, and barely got a mention. But then Paul Ryan, in celebrating this victory and talking about how great Donald Trump's coattails were in this election, he gleefully said, you know, essentially, we can't wait to cut down the forests. We can't wait to pollute the waters. We can't wait to bring back coal. This is what I think is the agenda, isn't it?
I think the agenda is that and then some.
Right.
I mean, I think we're going to see many, many things that not only Democrats but large numbers of people in the Republican Party and many of the people who voted for him don't want to see. So we've bought a pig and a pope. We're going to see what kind of nasty stuff comes along with this. But nonetheless, he exploited real issues that the Democratic Party and the establishment part of the Democratic Party has simply not only ignored, but, you know, a good part of the trade policy derives from the first Clinton, President Clinton's policies and the banking crisis as well. So we're paying for the move to the right of the Democratic Party on trade issues, on banking, finance, and many other issues, which Hillary was actually basically continuing the policies of her husband with slight amendments because she was forced to by the Bernie Sanders campaign. So there's a deep, deep bankruptcy of ideas in the Democratic Party, which I think Trump exploited brilliantly for his own purposes.
Well, clearly, I think in the future, Democrats like Elizabeth Warren are going to be taken more seriously, and Bernie Sanders already has proven he has enormous amount of appeal. In fact, a recent poll by The Economist has Bernie Sanders as the most trusted politician in America, far above Hillary Clinton or Donald Trump. And given that the Republicans plan not just to get rid of the Affordable Care Act, but also get rid of Dodd-Frank, it would seem that this might be the moment for Elizabeth Warren and Bernie Sanders to step up and take a leadership role in the Democratic Party if the Democrats are to become the Democrats again.
Oh, I think that's absolutely right, and I think they both will. This election has scuttled the old part of the Democratic Party. They are largely irrelevant, and I think the Bernies and Elizabeth Warren have got to step up and take leadership. I think it's going to take a lot more than that on the ground. I mean, one of the deep problems is the union structure has, in all of the advanced industrial systems, labor unions were the powerful backing of a progressive position, and they've declined radically in the United States to 35% of the labor force, now down to 11% and only 6% in the private sector. So there's a weakness there. So we're going to have to redevelop the whole basis of the next politics. That's going to include the worker ownership and community structures and community-owned co-ops and all manner of things that the kind of new economy movement's building on the ground to lay down some institutional base for a new politics to replace labor. But you're absolutely right. Elizabeth Warren and Bernie are going to be important to this at one level, but activists on the ground are going to be even more important in laying groundwork for something really positive.
And what do you think can be done about the people that have placed their hopes in Donald Trump, who is clearly such a manifest fraud, has never cared about anybody else but himself and his own pursuit of aggrandizement and money? Surely they're going to be disappointed. Is that necessary? Do you have to really go through this kind of painful lesson that we've all been had and then pick up the pieces after that?
We'll see. I think that's the most likely reality, that we're going to see opposition within his own party. Trump himself, I think, is unprincipled. So he may very well go to the left in his actual practice. I mean, you can look at the fascist regimes, which in some areas had full employment and even better medical programs, because it was a useful way to stay in power. So Trump, who I think has no ideology on these issues, he's been very much for expanding Social Security, he says. He's been talking, about taking on the big banks and Wall Street, who taking on trade. He's a very idiosyncratic politician, and I think if that helps him, his position, he may very well move to the left on these issues. I think you can't characterize him as an ideologue in that respect. I think he doesn't care at all except to help himself and maybe even has some patriotism about this. It's very unusual characteristics that we're seeing. He's not part of the traditional Republican business position on any of this, and he may very well have a potpourri of things that he thinks benefit him.
Well, already we've learned from negotiations at the time of the Republican convention, which was held in Ohio, and the governor of the state boycotted the convention in protest. In order to win him over, Trump sent his son, Donald Trump Jr., over to negotiate with Governor Kasich and basically offering him the vice presidency. And apparently the conversation went thus. Kasich was offered both the domestic portfolio and foreign affairs. And Kasich's people said, well what is Donald Trump going to do? He's going to make America great again. That was the answer. So do you think that he will be even a president? Maybe he just likes the trappings and he's going to hand off the actual work to Mike Pence, who's an extremely conservative Republican, very reactionary on social issues.
I think we're going to see how that turns out. I mean, I think if he had offered Kasich those positions, I doubt very much once he got in office, Kasich would have those positions. I think Donald Trump would control that action one way or another. But I think his bottom line test will be whether or not it benefits him politically. And I wouldn't be surprised he starts spending money in a way that you saw the old right wing do, because it benefited them. I mean, the real right wing in Europe. Or he might not. I mean, he's a total, on these issues, I think he's unprincipled and unknown, but I wouldn't assume that he's going to take the traditional conservative Republican position at saving money and tax issues. He's for expanding Social Security, as I said. I think if that's the politics that works for him, he may very well surprise people. Not that he's going to do what progressives are going to want in general, but he may have a very mixed bag of policies, including military policies, of course, which will be the biggest economic expansion program.
Well, just in closing, Gaur Apovitz, what would your advice be to the American left, which is one of the things that's worth pointing out is that 7 million fewer Democrats voted in this election than did vote in the last election, which re-elected Barack Obama. The African-American vote was down, the millennial vote was down, and of course, a lot of people on the left wasted their vote on Jill Stein and Gary Johnson. So again, we seem to be crippled by the balkanization of the left, identity politics, and essentially an unexplained apathy in the face of perhaps the most dangerous proto-fascist that American politics has ever seen.
Well, I think in some ways, at one level, the answer is pretty straightforward and obvious. I mean, organize, organize, and organize. Roll up your sleeves and get out and begin to build the next movement. And some of that's happening, which is very exciting. There, people are saying it's time to rebuild the basis of a serious progressive left political movement at the grassroots level, starting at the local communities and working up. That's the big picture. The second picture is to begin laying down institutions of, what Bernie called democratic socialism, publicly or community-owned cooperatives, worker-owned companies, public utilities. The next time General Motors and the big banks collapse, make them into public utilities, beginning to build a very different program from the bottom up. I'm a historian. I understand the time dimensions of this. But movements begin and build from the bottom up over time. It's rather routine in some sense. The civil rights movement in the 1930s was nowhere. It took three decades to achieve triumph. I think that's the way progressives ought to begin looking at rebuilding the whole basis of a progressive system-changing movement that begins to ask questions about moving beyond the giant corporations and the big banks towards a very decentralized, community-based system, which also is unafraid of taking on and making some of these big guys into utilities, to public utilities. So I think that's the direction. And indeed, the new economy movement, which is kind of vibrant in many parts of the country, the Next System Project, there is a big movement beginning to develop the ideas and the practices and the experiments. City-owned banks in Santa Fe and Philadelphia are being developed. There are, 3 million people involved in co-ops. Worker-owned and some credit unions are democratized. We're seeing a lot of experimentation, which I see as the prehistory of the development of a serious new progressive movement that moves well beyond traditional liberalism. But again, that's work, ongoing, hard work for the development of movements like the civil rights movement, the feminist movement, the environmental movement, the anti-war movements. They take time. And one needs to roll up one's sleeves and be determined about it. But I think the movements are beginning to develop, and it's in that sense, it's a very interesting, exciting period of history, despite all the pain and despite the losses like the one to Trump.
Well, I thank you very much for joining us, Guy Alpovitz.
Oh, thanks very much. Glad to be with you.
And again, I've been speaking with Guy Alpovitz, who's a historian, political economist, activist, writer, and government official. He's currently a professor of political economy at the University of Maryland and is a former fellow of King's College at Cambridge University, Harvard's Institute for Politics, and a guest scholar at the Brookings Institution. He also serves as a legislative director in the U.S. House of Representatives and the U.S. Senate, and as a special assistant in the Department of State, and is the co-founder of the Democracy Collaborative at the University of Maryland, and the author of What Then Must We Do? This has been Background Briefing. I'm Ian Masters. I'd like to thank producer Graham Fitzgibbon. This program is available for podcasting at ianmasters.com, where you can scroll down on the right-hand side to subscribe to iTunes podcasts. And I'll be back again tomorrow with another Background Briefing. Bye for now.